we have live route setting. The resetting will be done during the competition between rounds. Yeah, I would say we'll keep the whole climber in view. We won't be having close-ups at the key moments, which I know drives people crazy on a lot of comps. And as I say, I'm not this kind of rabid capitalist trying to nail climbing and milk as much money as we can out of it. But if you want to pay an athlete 100 grand to win an event, that 100 grand has to come from somewhere. It's not going to come from thin air. We want to go to big cities, big arenas. I want to go to Madison Square Garden. I'll throw that out there right now. I think we should be, you know, we want to get in the Garden. We want to get in Wembley Arena. We want to be in Staples Center in LA. We want to go really big.
Welcome to another episode of the That's Not Real Climbing podcast. I'm your host, Ginny, and I'm excited to introduce my guest for today, Charlie Bosco. This is Charlie's second time on the podcast, and this time he's back with a big announcement. For those who aren't familiar, Charlie preceded Matt Groom as the IFSC/World Climbing commentator. This time, he's back to talk about the brand new competition series, Pro Climbing League. In this episode, we'll go over all the details of what a PCL competition will look like, the challenges they faced the past 5 years putting this together, and I'm diving into all of the finances as well. I hope you enjoy this episode with Charlie. Please pardon this brief intermission, but I'm excited to talk about Madrock's newest and softest shoe yet, the Remora Pro. If you like being able to feel the chips you're standing on, and you like not having to worry about standing on sketchy volumes in competitions, then this is the soft shoe for you. They also have a crazy 3D heel that allows you to get more surface area when heel hooking, and inserts that lock your heel into the shoe no matter how hard you're pulling. Feel free to message me if you have any questions about the shoes or sizing, and you can use the discount code NOTREALCLIMBER for 10% off your entire Madrock order. Thank you to Madrock for helping to sponsor the podcast. Now back to the show. Well, how are you doing today? Any holiday plans for you?
Yeah, a bit of skiing, bit of family time, friends and family, skiing. That's about it. Pretty quiet Christmas. Just got back from the Netherlands, so feeling pretty worked.
Ah, for work or?
Yeah, we had a PCL test event.
Okay. Yes. So I didn't, is there like anything about that online or is it like a download test event?
Not at all. About the test event.
Well, like, is it filmed anywhere or is there any like video?
Yeah,
we
took some footage. Other media outlets were there. Red Bull were there. So no, definitely nothing secretive about it. It was at a place called Grip. In Nijmegen, on the German border, and it was great, super productive, but so busy, like, horribly busy. But that's fine.
Did it go well?
It went great. Yeah, we learned a lot. We were testing everything from format to route setting, style, different camera setups. Yeah, it's great.
Okay, we'll have a question about that later, so we'll definitely get into that.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, before we get too deep into those things, for those who don't know you super well, what's your background in the comp climbing community?
I started out in terms of comp climbing, working for Epic TV and presenting their Climbing Daily show. And I went to some World Cups and I thought, oh, this is cool. I like this. So I ended up getting a job at the IFSC, since renamed World Climbing. I will probably make that mistake.
Same, yeah.
10 times on this podcast.
Okay.
Yeah. Ended up working at the IFSC for 5 years as their lead presenter and commentator on the World Cups, World Championships, Youth World Championships, anything they broadcast, I was talking over, and then stopped that in 2020 when COVID came along, and still do some freelance commentary, done a couple of Arco Rockmasters, a couple of Red Bull Dual Ascents in Switzerland. And have also been working on the recently launched Pro Climbing League.
I guess now that I think about it, did you leave IFSC/World Climbing to focus on the Pro Climbing League?
No, I didn't. I think we talked about this last time, but I 5 years just felt like a logical time to do it. It's a very tiring job, a lot of travel, time away, and I just felt like I'd kind of done it, and every season was still enjoyable, but it didn't have quite the same feeling of this huge challenge that it did the first year. I was kind of comfortable, and that has its place in life, but I just felt like I was ready for a new challenge. So I think that when I started at IFSC, I always had in the back of my mind that I'd do it for 5 years, because I started in 2016, and 5 years later would have been the Olympics, climbing's first Olympics. So it was always kind of this logical time to stop. And as time went by, it still seemed like the right time to stop.
Mm-hmm. And then it was the right time to start actually looking into the Pro Climbing League stuff. That's when it started.
Yeah, I would say looking into is the correct terminology.
Okay. Yeah.
Which, you know, I think 5 years ago, we thought we knew how to run the climbing league. And much of the last 5 years has been taking it up with realizing how little we knew then. And hopefully we know a little bit more now. But yeah, it's been a long process, much longer than I could ever have envisaged when we started out on it. But there's something great, there's something wonderful about the kind of naivety and optimism of just thinking, we could start a professional climbing league. It can't be that hard. It turns out it is pretty hard, but you can do it if you keep going.
Yeah, so for people who don't know too much about Pro Climbing League or haven't heard about it, I guess what's the gist of it? What's the overview?
Okay, so the IFSC World Cups and the competitions they run are great. However, we just felt that there was space for something else alongside it. A new format, a new business model, a new way of broadcasting. Really, we took apart everything that currently exists in competition climbing and we said, how could you make this better? And the Pro Climbing League is the result of that conversation. Now, without wishing to state the obvious, that conversation was pretty long and it involved literally hundreds of people whose opinions we asked and whose advice we sought, but it is basically a new comp series with every element of what comps currently are studied and ideally made a little bit better or at least tweaked. So it's completely different from what IFSC/World Climbing do, and it's designed to run in alongside that, but just offer something different to people.
Is if it's going to run alongside IFSC, it's going to be like separate dates or like season from the world climbing season?
I know. Maybe we just call it IFSC.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding.
Next time.
I'm trying to get into the habit. I'm trying. We're going to have multiple events. So London on the 28th of February is the debut, but there'll be lots more across the States, Asia, mainland Europe. So there's a lot more events to come, but they will be outside the IFSC's season.
Okay, that makes sense. So what will the format look like?
Okay, so the format is head-to-head. And the way it works is that we have two identical boulders. So if I was competing against you, it's whoever gets to the top first is a winner. If no one gets to the top, it's who got to the highest hold. And if we both got to the same hold, whoever got there first is the winner. So head-to-head formats have sometimes had a hard time because people think it's speed bouldering. And Adidas Rockstars, which was a good example of a head-to-head format, I went to several times and it was fantastic. It was an amazing event. But they had a head-to-head boulder to finish and they put a buzzer on top and if you have a buzzer, you have to have someone who presses it. And if you have to have someone who presses it, you have to have someone who tops. And so therefore the boulders were generally pretty easy and it was really who climbed it fastest. And we want to avoid that. It's not speed bouldering. It's hard climbing. It just happens that instead of you going, then me going, then the next person going, two of us are side by side. But it doesn't, it's definitely not speed bouldering. It's hard climbing, but with two climbers on the wall at the same time in a head-to-head format.
How many boulders like per round, I guess?
Yeah, so there are eight. This is per gender. Eight climbers per gender. You get paired up. So we have a seeding competition the day before. That's behind closed doors. That's not broadcast, but we seed the climbers the day before. So we get paired up. So again, for example, me and you would be paired together. By the way, we have a men's and a women's categories. It's not mixed, but for the purposes of this podcast, we would get paired up and we would compete on a best of three boulders. And whoever wins two of the boulders progresses to the semi-final. And then the semi-final is just one boulder. So you'd be head-to-head against whoever. So if you won our pair, for example, in round one, you would get paired up against the winner of another pair on the semi-final. And that basically determines who's going to go into the small final, third, fourth run, and the big final, which is first and second. But they're different boulders. Obviously, you have the three boulders in the qualifying round. The semi-final is then a different boulder. The small final is a different boulder. And the big final is also a different boulder. So you have to win, you have to win at least four boulders, but if it could be five, depending on how the qualification round goes, if you win 2-0 or 2-1.
Okay. Is qualification and semis and finals all like in a row, like on the same day?
Yeah, it's all in one event. So we'll do one gender's qualifying round, round one, another gender, and then all the knockout rounds. So for example, it'd be the men's semis, then small final, then big final, and then it'd be the women's afterwards, women's semis, women's small final, women's big final.
Do you need like a ton of wall space? Like it's all going to be set at the same time? Or
we have live route setting.
Oh, wow.
So the resetting will be done during the competition between rounds, which as I'm sure you are currently contemplating involves quite quick changeovers. And this is something that we're working on. It's one of the things we were studying in the Netherlands at GRIP was how do we get that process to be quicker? How do we make it super accurate? Just trying to improve our systems around that. And we've done a lot of work on it and made a lot of progress. So those route setting breaks will be remarkably quick. It's pretty amazing how quick you can go. So I actually think it's quite a cool element of the competition. I think people in the arena and to an extent people at home watching the broadcast will enjoy watching that element of it.
I guess, like, how do you keep people engaged during that break? Are you going to be commentating?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. I think it's a little bit too much to be heavily involved with the organization and then having to commentate. I'm not sure that I could combine both those things.
Yeah.
We've got a few ways of I guess you'd call it gamifying those reset breaks and making them engaging to watch. The flow of the show at times, we'll want to focus on that route setting. At other times, we might want to take people's attention away. People in the arena, at some stage, you need a break. So some of the resetting breaks will be kind of engaging with that process. And other times, we might not engage with it and people just go and grab a beer and have a break. But it's amazing how fast you can change bowlers with a skill team.
How much time does it take?
Ooh, I would say with enough well-trained people, you can get all three duplicated bowlers. So it's effectively, so we have three walls, each will have two bowlers on it, like one bowler duplicated. So effectively it's six bowlers, albeit three times two. We reckon we can change the whole lot in 10 minutes.
Okay.
Which, when we first tried it, seemed ridiculous. But actually, we've done a lot of work to bring that time down.
Yeah, I mean, I could see it. I mean, you already know where the holds are going to go, and then if you just have like a bunch of people, seems doable.
It's a bunch of people who are well organized and know the boulders as well, because you've got to think, you've got to put start tape on, you've got to put a disc saying top with tape at the top. You're potentially moving volumes, you're going up and down the ladder, you've got to make sure there are no screws left on the stage. So you can't, if you drop any screws, they've got to get picked up. It's all these little details. But it's actually really, it's been really fun and actually really satisfying figuring that process out.
I'm sure it'll get faster too. It's kind of like the F1 tire changing process, it seems like.
Yeah, exactly. I think the record for changing four tires on an F1 car is under 2 seconds now. So
that'd be cool to see.
I think 2 second boulder changes may be a little bit beyond us right now, but never say never.
It'll be interesting to see. I could see people finding just the whole changeover process cool to watch.
Yeah, well, I think climbers are interested in route setting. any route setting video always does well. And it's kind of this, it's like this mystique around route setting because it's a creative science. It's science, but it's also completely creative. So there's, it's a really fascinating process, route setting. And especially when you see over a dozen people descend on the stage and quickly swap out six boulders. I think that's really cool to watch. And I've watched it a few times, but to see it with a crowd, I think it's going to be really, really exciting.
Yeah, that'll be cool. And then you said that there are 8 athletes per gender. I guess, like, how did they get chosen? Or, like, in the future, if this becomes a bigger thing, how do people become one of the 8 people who get to attend?
So right now it's invitation only. Just because when you've only got 8 each side, if we went down the road of trying to qualify people, then suddenly we've got to organize qualification events. There's a whole lot that comes along with that. So for now, it's invitation only. We will invite 7 people per gender. And then there's actually going to be a wildcard event in London, the details of which are now on social media at Pro Climbing League, where you can qualify and grab that 8th spot. And they are more or less open. So somebody is going to qualify for the event.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know. How cool is that? How cool is that? I mean, I love that. But longer term, what we would love to have is a pyramid system whereby, I don't know, for people that watch the Free Ride World Tour, the skiing, it's probably a good example of it. But at the top, you have PCL. Maybe below it, there's tier 1, tier 2, 3, 4, and going down. And we would love to have events more or less in every gym in the world that had a clear pathway into qualifying for the PCL.
Oh.
So kind of like you have in European soccer, if you play in the North London Sunday League or whatever, in theory, if you keep getting promoted, you keep winning the league and you keep going tier by tier, you can end up in the Premier League. We would love to have that in the PCL, and that's kind of the longer term goal, is that there are qualifications all over the world and you qualify for your regional, then your national, then the PCL qualifying. But not right now. That's a lot to set up.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That'd be cool. Anyone need buy-in from all the gyms?
Yeah, there's work to do around that. But yeah, longer term, we'd like a qualification system, I think. It's to be decided how we do it. I think Free Ride World Tour, a few people you invite, few people qualify, and maybe a local wildcard every week, something like that.
Cool. So should I like fly out to London and try to compete and get in? Or
You totally should. Yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing we're looking for. I mean, how good would it be if the wild card won? I think that'd be amazing.
If I became the wild card, no way. No shot. I don't think so.
I don't know. I'm not sure. This Yanya, what's her name? Garley Bray?
Yanya. I think so.
Yeah, something like
that. You think I could beat her?
Well, maybe she's not all she's cracked up to be. I mean, till you try, you don't know. I saw her climb a couple of times and she looked pretty impressive to me, but...
Okay,
yeah.
We'll see.
Hey, you've got to be in it to win it.
I think maybe if everyone mysteriously gets super injured, I'll have a shot.
Yeah, I mean, that's really my only shot of winning a PCL event is like mass sickness or you know, some sort of mass casualty event, which means I'm the only person with 2 functioning arms, I think, other than that.
But you wouldn't be allowed to compete.
Yeah, we should check, actually. We haven't written any rules around that. I don't think we have a rule saying PCL employees can't compete. So maybe I should dust my shoes off.
You said you're even too busy to commentate, so I don't think you really have the time to compete.
Yeah, but now you got me dreaming now.
So if people want to watch you compete, how do people watch?
If they want to watch me compete, they'll need to fall asleep and have a very specific dream.
Okay.
If they want to see professional climbers compete, then the whole thing will be broadcast on Red Bull TV. Or if you're in London, even better, buy a ticket.
Yeah.
The tickets go on sale 8th of January.
Okay. Yes, that's coming up soon.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this. Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Is there anything that you feel like, thinking back on when you were commentating for IFSC World Climbing, is there anything that like really irritated you about that at that time, about things they did or like decisions they had made, that you kind of now understand going through the process of setting up a competition yourself?
That's a good question. I think the overall understanding of how hard it is to put on a climbing comp comes. It's so easy to watch the IFSC and go, why doesn't the cameraman show us the angle we want to see? Why is that boulder set that way? Oh, it's so obvious that the zone should be the hole before. It's so obvious that all this stuff. And actually, once you start dealing with the challenges of setting up a climbing comp, I probably have a lot more empathy for how challenging it is. We all think we could do better, right? We all think, well, if I had a comp, this would be the format and I'd broadcast it this way and these would be the athletes and these would be the sponsors and these would be the holes I've used and we'd have this type of boulder wrap. But, and that's great and that's exactly what we thought. But then you actually start running into financial reality and you actually start running into the politics of who will and won't work together. You start running into how sponsors get rewarded, and actually you can't build the sponsorship model you thought you could build, and you can't build the format you thought you could build because of a million logistical issues. So I would say anything that did frustrate me, I have definitely become more empathetic about, because it's bloody hard to make a climbing competition.
Was there any like specific like example you can think of where it was like, wow, egg on my face kind of experience?
I'd say the venues would be one of them, because some of the venues we went to at the World Cups, you think, oh, it's not a great venue. But actually, venues are really expensive. It costs so much to rent a venue. So if it costs so much, someone's got to pay for it. So how do you make enough money to pay for a venue? And actually, you can't just say, well, let's just go in Wembley Arena in London. Let's just go into Madison Square Garden. It doesn't work like that. It's really expensive and logistically challenging to get in and out of those places, not just in terms of hiring them out, but the logistics of how you get your walls in there, that's challenging. The logistics of how you sell tickets and where you sell tickets and how much you price them, that's all really challenging. So I think, probably venues is the one where I sometimes thought that the venues we were using weren't great. But now, having tried to find my own venues, I appreciate that it's not as easy as it might seem. And there's an awful lot more goes into it than where would be a really cool venue.
What were some of like the costs you saw for certain venues?
I think that information may not be publicly available, but we are talking, but we're talking, it's tens of thousands of pounds, euros per day, multiple tens of thousands per day for any decent venue. And one of the challenges is you've got to pay for it before your event. So if you're counting on selling the tickets, it won't work, because you don't get your ticket money till after the event. You've got to pay for the arena beforehand. So there's all these kind of logistical issues that when you're dreaming of how you would do things, perhaps you don't think about. I know we were guilty of not thinking about it. I mean, I remember thinking, well, we'll find an arena that seats 10,000 people, because I remember IFSC, as it was then, sold out the biggest arena in Paris, 12,000 seats in 2012. And they did it again in 2016. And I went to it. And to be in an arena with 12,000 people watching climbing is pretty awesome. So naively, I just thought, well, let's get an arena, 10,000 seats, £50 a seat. You got 500 grand, half a million bucks. Yeah, that's plenty. It doesn't really work that way, because you've got to stump up the cash to pay for the arena. You've actually got far more expenses than you think. You've got to bring a wall in. You've got to buy holds, route setters, staff, all the expenses of people staying in that city. It doesn't. it's not quite as simple as saying, if we sell 10,000 tickets at £50 each, we've got enough money to run our event. Sadly, it proved, you know, we quite pretty quickly learned that that is not the simple mathematic equation it might appear.
I definitely want to go more into financials in a bit later, depending on how willing you are to talk about all the things that go into the financials. But before we get into that, just more about like the whole planning process. What sparked the idea for this?
I think when your job is to go to loads of events, you can't help but think about what you do to improve them. And that was just something I always thought about everywhere we went. Just naturally, you're curious. I'm curious and I'd be looking there and thinking, wow, I would have put the stage over here, or I would have done it this way. Or I feel like the comps go a bit quiet in this stage of the format. So if I had a format, I would try and get rid of that element of it. So if you take the format as an example, we kind of looked at all three disciplines of climbing and wrote down what's good about them, what's bad about them. Okay, how do we keep the three columns of good and get rid of the three columns of bad? And you can't do it entirely. But how do we kind of take the best thing about lead, the best thing about speed, the best thing about boulder, and put them in one format? And we had so many iterations of our format, some of which have made it through to the final version and some of which haven't. But yeah, I would say, I don't remember what your question was actually, but how it came about. And I think it's just that process organically of thinking about how would I change this if you could do it differently. And I would say the World Cups are great. I went to 100. They're really good. But they're just, I just felt there was space for something else. And that's all this is. It's not us. It sounds like I'm kind of finding fault with the World Cups. It's not that. It's just saying, if I had a blank slate, which obviously IFSC don't, because they're an established organization who are tied into member federations and the International Olympic Committee. But if I had a blank slate, what would I do? And that was more me philosophizing. And then I met Danan, and he kind of had a lot of the same thoughts. And we just started talking about it. And one thing I would say about this whole thing is that there's this insane power to actually starting something versus having it in your own head. So it probably sounds a bit of an unrelated example, but I saw a documentary about a guy who wanted to sea kayak from Australia to New Zealand. And his best friend said, now we all know that's impossible. You can't do that, right? And he goes, but you sit in the pub and order a round of beers and start saying, okay, if you did do it, how would you do it? It actually, in a very funny way, it makes it possible. Because you're actually starting to solve the problems. You're saying, okay, well, we can't do it. But how long would it take? It'd take 21 days. Well, if you were going for 21 days, you'd have to tow something behind the kayak. Okay, well, if you're going to tow something, what would you tow? What would it look like? How would it work? And you actually start making it possible by the act of discussing it, if that makes sense. And that's, I think that, right, when I saw that documentary, it really resonated with me because I thought, oh yeah, that's kind of what happened to us. When I look at what we've finally managed to put together and how long it's taken, it essentially was impossible. But there's just this incredible strength to just starting to talk about it. Because as soon as you start talking about it, you start saying, okay, you know, obviously we can't start a climbing league, but if we did, what would your format be? We can't start a climbing league, but if we did, what venues would you go to? We can't start a climbing league, but if we did, who would you invite? Suddenly you start putting these pieces together. So that's been pretty remarkable, is the power of actually just getting started on something.
Did he do it?
He made it into New Zealand waters and capsized. And they found the boat, they didn't find him. Yeah.
Wait, so he's dead?
He died, yeah, he died on it. But he made it. He was in sight of New Zealand. Yeah, I know. So it's kind of a super sad documentary and everything, but I'm a sucker for adventure stories and things. So
wait, what's it called?
I knew you were gonna ask that and I can't remember now.
Oh, okay. I'll look it up, I guess.
Yeah, you'll be able to find it if you Google Sea Kayak Australia, New Zealand, it should pop up. Andrew, what's his name? Andrew something. Anyway. I knew you were going to ask, and I was the whole time I was thinking, what's it called? What's
yeah.
It called? And now it's gone.
Well, hopefully you don't follow a similar fate, I guess. It'd be pretty terrible if you ended up dying halfway through.
Exactly. I feel like there's a million ways this could go, but that hopefully is not one of the outcomes. Whereas I think sea kayak in the Tasman Sea, you've taken...
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
A little bit more risk.
Yeah, good luck. So one of the Instagram questions I got from Graydon Solanders was what prompted the head-to-head format. If you're interested in ad-free episodes and would like to unlock over 4 hours of deleted scenes, including one where Charlie talks about criticism and what he's most stressed about for the competition, do consider helping support this podcast on Patreon. Some other perks include a membership pin shipped to you after 2 months, prioritized guest questions, or the ability to submit video questions, and more to come. The proceeds go back into the podcast, help me break even, and they help me improve the experience of the guests. If you'd like to help out non-monetarily, liking, commenting, and sharing helps a great deal as well. Back to the show.
That's a really good question. I think one of the frustrations I have with a lot of climbing comps is there's kind of multi elements to this. For a start, you don't see direct competition. So I think if you see tennis or soccer or whatever, there's this person on the right and there's this person on the left, and they're going at it. And they are competing with each other, and you can see them both. And we don't have that in climbing. And I think when we talked about why speed was great, we said it's fantastic because there is this sociological, psychological element that there's someone standing next to me. And it doesn't affect what I do, but it does affect what I do. And I think that's really interesting. And I think climbing, having an I go, you go format, which we traditionally had in climbing, it removes that element of competition. And I wanted to see that. So that was one of them. Another element is it's not nearly as engaging or easy to follow when it's I go, you go, because let's say you come out, try the boulder, you get the zone, but you don't get the top. And then 4 climbers later, the other person who's racing to win comes out. I can't really remember what you did unless I've really dialed in and making notes, which is what I used to do commentating. I'd make notes of, you know, Ginny got here, so I'll remember that one. But for the average viewer at home, they're not remembering that stuff. So it's actually kind of hard to work out what the person before did and therefore where that leaves you. It's kind of hard to follow the competition in that respect. And the final thing, probably the most key, is we wanted a really clear winning moment. And I think one of the frustrations I've always had with climbing formats, again, with the exception of speed, is someone can win and you don't know they won until half an hour later. And the best example I give of this always is one of the Briançon World Cups. There were really strong climbers in the final. I don't remember who. And there was a young Japanese kid, 19 years old. I'd never heard of him. So I went to the Japanese coach, did my research, figured out how to say his name properly, got a bit of background. So I'd have something to say in commentary. And this kid was out first. Kid, he was 19. But, you know,
sure, yeah.
That's a kid.
Yeah.
He climbed, and obviously I said, hey, oh, here he is, you know, talked to his coaches earlier, gave a bit of background, did my best to commentate this guy and respect his achievement to get into the final, but didn't really give him like a big intro or make a big deal when he fell off. Anyway, the final goes on. It turns out he won. But by the time he won, he climbed an hour ago. So he had a winning moment that was an hour old. So it was really, I really wanted to solve that winning moment thing. I wanted you to sit at home and go, I can see my screen, so I know that that person is winning. They're winning because they're ahead of the person next to them, and therefore they win. I wanted that kind of clarity in that big moment. So that's kind of where head-to-head came from. And I know head-to-head at times gets a hard deal, but it is. It's hard climbing. They're just next to each other.
Does it get like criticism? I haven't heard
a few people have said to us, well, I just don't want this to be speed boulder, which I get. I don't either.
I didn't know that's like the main thing that people would think of. I never like thought it would become speed based.
Well, the problem, you know, the at a very basic level, if I get there first, I beat you. So there is an element of time. But then what's interesting is when you actually start doing a little bit more of a deep dive into this stuff, time corresponds very closely to attempts. So traditionally we measure attempts, whereas we're going to place a bigger focus on time. But actually the results are pretty much the same whether you measure attempts or time.
Like if you can like go faster, but you have to rest if it's like hard and you fall off.
Exactly, yeah. There's a pretty close correlation. Basically, whether we measured attempts or time, 99% of the time, the result will be the same.
Yeah, excited to see. Another audience submitted question related to this. Did you consult with athletes when developing the format, and what did that process look like?
We did. We didn't go out with a kind of formal questionnaire. I just called up athletes I know and got their take on it. And very luckily for me, having worked on the World Cups, I know some pretty good climbers. So they're kind of well-qualified opinions. But yeah, we really wanted to deliver for the athletes. I think one thing that's really clear is the athletes have to enjoy this. There's no use saying to them, trust us, this is the best format. I promise you, you know, maybe you don't like it, but I promise it's for the best. There's no use. They've got to love this. And I understand it's new. And so you might come in with a raised eyebrow and think, oh, I wonder what this is all about. But every climber who's actually taken part in a test just loved it. So yeah, we did. We consulted a lot of the world's best athletes to make sure that they were good with the format. And we scrapped some ideas based on what they said.
What got scrapped?
So I had a format, and I will die on this hill. I still think it would have been awesome. I think the finale of the comp should have been a high ball boulder over a foam pit. The cool thing about lead is the last minute of an attempt, right? Because they're just flamed and they're just living move to move, just about hanging on. That's the best bit of a lead attempt to me. The first minute, first 2 minutes is kind of ho-hum. But when they're really starting to scrap, that's great. And so I thought, could you have a side-by-side boulder that's, I don't know, 8 meters high? So it's long, we're talking. My math isn't very good, but maybe 20 moves, something like that. And so you basically take our format and put it on a high ball boulder as a great finale. And I just imagined like Madison Square Garden, and you got this big wall jacked up high above the crowd with people unroped 8 meters above the foam pit. I think that would have been awesome. A lot of athletes didn't like it.
Oh, really? What were their reasons? That also sounds like a financial issue. That's way more expensive.
With the benefit of hindsight, that financial issue might have become a clincher. But at the time, you know, we were dreaming.
Yeah.
They had safety concerns over it. Even though I actually went to a place with a foam pit in Montana, and you can land in the foam pit head first. You can't tell. Like the airbag system, airbags aren't good. So people have tried comps with airbags, but the airbag's pretty hard when you hit it from 8 meters. So no airbag, but a foam pit. But yeah, a risk of injury. I think there was a feeling that it was a bit gimmicky, which I don't think it was, but that's fine. That's why we called the athletes, is to say, what do you think? And if they say, we don't like your baby, which is effectively what their feedback was, and you just got to stomach it. And actually, I think logistically and in terms of credibility, if you go out to the climbing world, you say, oh, we're going to do a high ball above a foam pit. It does feel a bit like a gimmick, maybe. But if that happens in the future, you'll know it's because I got my way.
Okay.
And I managed to convince enough people that we should do it. I'll die on that hill. I would love the high ball. But that's a classic example of something where I thought particularly it was awesome. Some people pushed back on it, especially the athletes, so we scrapped it.
Are there any like big mistakes you feel like you have already made in the process?
I would say the hardest thing is keeping your was going to say emotion. I guess emotion, your emotions in check, because it's really easy to get off a phone call and think, oh, wow, this amazing thing's about to happen, or, oh, there's this complete disaster. And actually, I don't remember the quote, but that old the poem that if you can keep your head while all around you are losing theirs. Now I've forgotten the rest of the poem, but the basic point is, you know, keep your head together, you'll be okay. So I think just staying balanced, not getting too high, not getting too low would be a big thing. I think we got let down by a few people. So I would definitely advocate people to get everything down on paper. If you think you've got an agreement, a handshake's great. And I like to work on a handshake, but getting it in black and white's never a bad idea.
I think my highs are very high and my lows are very low. So maybe I need to read that poem.
No, I'm the same. I'm the same. And it's we've got off some calls. Obviously, during this 5 years, we didn't think it was going to take 5 years. We always thought it was about to happen. And you can get off a call and you think, oh, like, oh, we made it happen. And we kind of took steps. And like we founded the company 3-4 years ago because it looked like it was about to happen. And it didn't happen. So we've... And then you kind of buy a website and you start making the website and then it doesn't happen. And see, you keep thinking it's going to happen and it doesn't. So I think, if anyone knows how to do that thing where you don't get too high and too low, then please let me know because I definitely am not able to do it, but I wish I could.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. And then another audience submitted question about the planning, or I guess more about like the broadcasting side of things. They said, we as viewers often gripe about videography and production values. What is the best way to capture and broadcast a comp and any interesting challenges you expect from this one?
I would say if in doubt at the key moment, zoom in on the climber's feet.
Hmm.
That's what I'm kidding.
Okay.
That's one of the criticisms you see a lot. No.
Yeah.
My mantra, whenever we went to a new World Cup and we kind of met the new cameramen, I always used to say, if in doubt, zoom out. We want to see the whole climber. We want to see where they're going. No problem seeing a bit of where they've been before on the boulder. So in some ways, the best way to film climbing is just to keep it pretty simple, which is to keep the whole climber visible and the next move visible. And really get some context of where they are. We're working with Red Bull on the bold, on the broadcast. They definitely know what they're doing when it comes to broadcasting. I would say we'll keep the whole climber in view. We won't be having close-ups at the key moments, which I know drives people crazy on a lot of comps.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to have very innovative angles. We're going to put cameras in places that haven't been put in climbing comps before. We've spent last week testing a lot of this, so I'm super excited to talk about it, but I have to kind of leave that to Red Bull. But suffice to say, we won't be cutting away at the key moment to show a close-up, and we have better angles and better quality broadcast equipment than you've ever seen in a comp before. How's that?
I had talked to... Antonin, who was doing broadcasting for the IFSC, and some of the issues he had mentioned was like when you're traveling around, you don't have access to the same camera people or people who necessarily know climbing. So how are you like fixing that issue?
Well, I actually spoke to Wanto this morning. He said hi.
Yeah.
For London is simple enough because Red Bull are bringing their production team. And going forward, that will likely be the case. So,
okay.
Are they
all around the world?
Yeah, they have the means to produce a broadcast of comparable quality anywhere in the world, pretty much. So, wherever we go, I don't anticipate any kind of drop off in broadcast quality, which that's one of the challenges on the World Cups is that every time you go, you get a new camera crew. The IFSC financially aren't in a position, understandably, to fly out camera operators to Japan when there are plenty of capable climbing camera operators already there. So I would say we won't have a drop-off in quality no matter where we go, but I understand why it does happen, having worked in the broadcasting for the World Cups, is that each time you go, you take a core staff, but you then have to get local operators. And that means you get a variety in quality. But that's not something that we will have to worry about.
Okay. I guess I just wonder, like, how come they didn't try to, I don't know, get a sponsor like Red Bull that has, I don't know, action sports broadcasting everywhere?
I don't know. Sorry, I'm not dodging the question. I just don't know.
Yeah, fair.
I would seem like a good partnership, but it's very hard. And especially with the World Cups, you've got so many. For a broadcast company, it would, if you think about the costs and the logistics of moving a sufficiently big crew around to do a great job of showing the World Cups, it would be a big investment for someone. So you'd want to be pretty confident you were going to get enough viewers to make that worth it.
True. Okay. Well, definitely want to get into the finances a bit. I hope that that's something you can disclose some information about.
Yeah.
So how did you get financing and sponsors for this event?
League. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. I shouldn't say event.
No, it's fine. It's fine. It's a slow process, I would say. I think once you land one, it's a lot easier is one thing I would say. One thing that I think we've got in our favor is we have a good contact list in the climbing industry. So early on, although most of them didn't end up working out, I could at least go to people that work at major brands and say, hey, we're thinking about doing this. What do you think? Like, what's your take on it? What would you, if we came to you, what would you be looking for? And so we had the opportunity to refine what we were doing to reflect what the brands were saying, which I think if you were coming in cold would be a lot trickier. You've got to go to whoever it is and say, hey, I'm Ginny. I want to start a climbing league. And they don't know who you are. And that makes it a lot trickier. So the old adage that it's who you know, not what you know, is so true, because we were just able to go to the head of marketing for Europe for big climbing brands and say, hey, man, can you meet me in the pub? You know, want to ask you some questions. And we could start learning pretty quickly. But once we landed a couple of sponsors, it made it a lot easier. So I would say getting the first one is the tricky bit. And if you have an in, if you have someone who can smooth your passage, then that makes it a lot easier. But yeah, I think for us, working with Red Bull is a huge deal, because even now, if we were to go out cold to sponsors and just say, hey, we're these people that really know about climbing. You remember me, I used to do the World Cups, you know, give us loads of money. That's pretty tricky to get them to put their hand in their pocket, especially a big sponsorship in climbing is not a big sponsorship by mainstream sports standards. And it's maybe not enough to move the needle on a big event like this. The amount that a climbing company would spend on sponsorship is not enough to really get something like this moving. So being able to say, hey, we're working with Red Bull. We convinced Red Bull that we could do this. I think, that was huge. That really opened the door for us. So yeah, getting the first one and getting a brand or someone who will stand up and say, yeah, I'm putting my money into this. I believe in this. So whoever the next person that comes along is not the first. That's the tricky bit, getting the first one.
And so what was the most expensive part of the whole process?
Oh, that's a good question. I haven't looked at the budget for ages, actually. Well, you know, the overall budget. I looked at the bit I'm managing. I'd say the venue.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
And if we weren't working with Red Bull, it would be the broadcast. Because if Red Bull weren't doing the broadcast, we would have to pay someone else to do it. So a lot of what you try and get is value in kind. If you think about the cost of booking an arena, flying out the climbers, accommodating the climbers, route setting, walls, holds, the broadcast, it's an awful lot of money. So if you can get someone who says, I'll give you the walls in return for sponsorship, I'll do the broadcast for you in return for sponsorship, that's when it starts to become possible. If you tried to get climbing brands to sponsor it, pull all that money together and then paid for it all, you would be at 10% of the amount of money you need.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'd say getting people to provide things in return for a sponsorship is the way, the way it works. By the way, we're still looking for a sponsor in some fronts. If any hotel in London thinks, oh, you know what, this sounds great, I'll give you 50 hotel rooms.
Oh, that'll be a tough one. Are you willing to give like an overall cost of the whole, like even just running this one event in London?
No.
Okay.
I don't really know why. I don't know why. It feels weird.
I know.
Yeah, it just feels weird. Talking about money. I hate talking about money. Talking about money. You know what I mean? It's always
but everyone wants
talking
to know,
money.
You know.
It's hundreds of thousands of dollars. Yeah, it's a lot of money. It's more money than I've ever seen, that's for sure. And I got to say, this whole thing would be easier if we were just rich.
Because
if you could just launch your event and not have to go, because what we were doing was we're saying, okay, so we think we've got this. So if we can convince, we think we've got A. So if we can convince B that A are on board, then B will sign up. And if B signs up, we've got A and B, which means that C, which we really need, then believes in it. And so you're always kind of spinning plates and trying to get enough people to commit that the next person commits. And then eventually you kind of hit critical mass and you think, oh, we actually have enough to make this happen. But if any one of those people pulled out, you're kind of back to square one. If you just had a pot, of money, it makes me realize, you look at, I was listening to Donald Trump the other day and he's talking about how he's a self-made man, except that his dad gave him $1 million.
No, yeah, exactly.
And you think, well, if somebody had just given us $1 million, we'd have been rolling 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a hell of a lot easier if you had a ton of capital behind you, but when you don't and you're kind of doing it from a standing start, it's definitely tricky. And a lot of it for us obviously is value in kind. So what we actually spend on this event won't be the total cost because people are doing things for free in return for being associated with it, but it's hundreds of thousands of dollars, multiple hundreds of thousands. So that's a lot of money for me.
It's a lot easier to make money when you have money.
Yeah, although according to Trump, he's a self-made man. It's just that $1 million just to get him off the ground and the private school. And when his dad died, he inherited $280 million more. But apart from that, self-made man.
Yeah. So what do you think you would do with $1 million? How would you make this event amazing if you had $1 million?
I think what you can do when you've got money is you've got more certainty.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, because as I said, when we're putting this together, you've got A, you've got B, you've got C. C pulls out. So then A get cold feet, they pull out. So you've only got B, and now B is shaky. So you've got to go and get D. You're kind of juggling all this stuff. And we were always absolutely straight with people. But to some extent, you are kind of putting it together piece by piece. And you're absolutely relying on that first person who said yes to stay yes. And if they change their mind, which did happen to us, you're about to scroll on. So I think if you had $1 million, it's not even that we'd be doing it differently. It's just you'd have, years ago, we'd have just had that certainty where we just go, okay, we're good. We pay ourselves a salary, so we don't need another job. We can book the arena. If we lose money on the event, well, that's okay. We've got our money. We can't lose money on the event. We've got a business to run and it has to function. So it would just give you that certainty, I think, would be the big thing.
People always ask like, oh, what would you do if you didn't have to worry about money? Or like, what would your work be? And I always say that I would just like run unprofitable businesses that are just like so fun.
Yeah, exactly.
It would just be so fun. I would just want to put on like the most fun event.
Yeah, exactly. And
I can dream.
It's kind of hard for us because we've always, sadly, in the intervening 5 years since we started talking about this, we haven't run into $1 million. So we've always been doing it without this lump of capital that we bring. We've always been doing it with the help of companies supporting us. So I've never really imagined what we would do if we had a massive pot of money.
So another audience submitted question from Instagram from Climbing GGGGGB. I think something a lot of people are wondering, what will the prize money look like?
I'm not sure if that information is publicly available yet. I've got to be careful because we've released some information, but not all information. The one thing I would say is it will be very, very high by the standards of climbing competitions. Definitely more than double what you win in your average climbing competition, your average World Cup. And the other thing I would say is big prize money is the kind of first thing we want. One of the first things we want to achieve with the league is we want really big prize money. That's not because we, it's appropriate that you get really well paid. You're performing at an elite level of something. And if the industry is big enough to support that prize money, which it is in climbing, then you should make a lot of money. And I think if you look at surf, skate, smaller, but similarly kind of niche, slightly outside the mainstream sports type sports, they have $100,000 for a win in their equivalent of the World Cup. And I think that's entirely appropriate. And we'd like to get there sooner rather than later. So paying the athletes more is a huge priority for us. And it'll be, by climbing standards, very, very good prize money in London, but it's going to scale quickly. And we actually spoke to, this is kind of random, but we spoke to a guy who is an agent for NBA players early on, and he said, as soon as you should pay the athletes more. Always pay the athletes more. And he said, because it makes it aspirational. So we, to some extent, some more than others, but we look up to rich people. If you hear that LeBron James or Steph Curry makes $100 million a year or whatever, it kind of puts them on a pedestal socially. So there's that, but also it increases the jeopardy. Imagine if someone's going out to the final boulder and if they top it or not, there's 50 grand riding on it. It's pretty cool. It increases that jeopardy. So it adds aspiration, kind of kudos to the athletes if you pay them well, and it also makes your comps more dramatic.
Yeah. I'm wondering, now that you've gone through this like financing and planning process, what do you think is the difference that allows these like similar size sports like skateboarding or surfing to pay out more to the athletes versus why it's just like not able to happen in climbing so far?
It's a really good question. I think that those leagues are set up as commercial entities. So what we have now with the IFSC is a federation, and a federation is a not-for-profit organization that has multiple member federations. So it makes it very hard to generate huge amounts of money. It also makes it very hard to make changes to your rules because you have to go through committees and a long, long process to really making any change to what you do. Whereas something like the World Surf League is a commercial operation. And we're not, when I say commercial operation, it gives things a hard time. We're not just out to make profit. But if you're a private business, you can basically say, our format didn't work in London because of, or this element of the format was problematic. We're just going to change it and it'll be better in the New York event. So I think also the way those leagues are set up is enables more sponsorship to come in. So if you look at current World Cups, you have to compete for your national federation. So you therefore have to wear federation gear, which means you can't advertise your sponsors as well. And the commercial opportunities for sponsors are pretty limited. You can kind of sponsor a climber's shoes or their chalk bag and nothing else. So then the World Cups, as amazing as they are and as good as they've been for our sport, I mean, wow, we've got to climb into the Olympics, but it's very hard to scale the commercial side of federation events. I think the other thing is the World Cups don't get massive viewing figures relative to the size of the climbing industry. I think if you look at World Surf League, Freeride World Tour, Skate, is it World Skate League? Could be. Whatever the professional league is in skating. I spent a lot of time studying it. I've just had a brain fart. But they get really good viewing figures. And the more people that watch your comps, the more valuable they are. So I think that's probably the two big factors is you need bigger viewing figures. You need more people watching. And you also need to structure it in a way that it's appealing for brands to sponsor. And as I say, I'm not this kind of rabid capitalist trying to nail climbing and milk as much money as we can out of it. But if you want to pay an athlete 100 grand to win an event, that 100 grand has to come from somewhere. It's not going to come from thin air. Mm-hmm. Someone has to put that in because it has to be worth 100 grand for them to sponsor the event. So yeah, you need more viewing figures and you need more commercial opportunities. But we're always conscious that we don't ever want this to feel like it's just a commercial. It's got to be done subtly, and we'll happily leave some money on the table to maintain the quality and the sanctity of the event. So it's a constant balance.
Yeah, I think it's hard when so many climbers like actively hate competition climbing. I don't really know where that even came from.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? It's very unusual. The numbers vary, but I think as a conservative estimate, there are 60 million climbers in the world. And if you look at the viewing figures for competitions, it's a very small percentage of that, like less than 1%, which is incredible, really. There aren't many sports where 1% of people who do that sport watch it at its highest level. That's very, very unusual. Maybe, I don't know, every sport in the world. I'm inclined to say it's unique.
Yeah.
But there may not be another sport where that's the case. And I understand it. I know I've worked on World Cups. I'm thinking, this is amazing. If you love climbing, you've got to be watching this. And there are other World Cups where it's not amazing. And not all our events are going to be exceptional, but you're going to have some are better than you watch soccer, you watch your NFL, whatever. Some games are better than others. That's fine. But I think if you can consistently put on something that more people want to watch, I feel like a lot of people will get over that.
So I think they kind of solved the whole thing where there's like events that aren't that interesting by adding in gambling. I've been getting really deep into the sports betting, not personally sports betting, but exactly. I get a lot of content about sports betting.
The podcast needs to start paying, right? You got to pay back.
But I'm just so interested in sports betting, and it like really solved the issue of there being like boring football games or like boring whatever where you don't feel a connection to the team or you like don't like it's like two really bad teams and no one really cares. And I feel like that kind of solved that part where now people even want to watch those games just because they have like money in it. So yeah. I really want to bring gambling into climbing.
I don't know. On the face of it, I'm not adverse to it, but I'd want to take a pretty long, hard look at what that would really look like.
I guess it is terrible, but man, it sure would work.
It works. But I mean, in Europe, we've had legalized sports betting forever. But in the States and Canada, it's been a more recent development. And I think I think betting has changed a lot with phones. Back in the day, you had to go to a physical betting shop and write on a piece of paper what your bet was. With a phone now, it's completely instant. And I don't think it hasn't quite bottomed out how that's going to work long term and what the pluses and minuses of it are. But who knows? I'm definitely never say never, for sure. But I'd want to do some investigation.
Yeah. If someone wants to figure this out with me, totally interested in.
Are you into sports betting?
No, I've never tried it. I think I'm in California and I don't think we're allowed to. I like really wanted to try out when you get like the new bets, they have like the new sign-on opportunities. And I really wanted to try it out. But I think it's not legal in California.
You know, I love the NFL. And when I go and watch the NFL in the pub or at someone's house, whatever, everyone I know gambles on it. And it's great because I get to live vicariously through them, but it's never my money at stake.
Yeah.
But
it still
I can
makes it exciting.
Yeah, but I can totally see how you end up spending a load of money on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I kind of have a reasonable understanding of the apps just from sitting with people. and talking about what they're betting on. They're pretty smart, those apps. They're pretty good at making you spend money. So
yeah,
it's a super interesting area for sure.
I've even seen videos. I don't know like how real this is because I never actually saw it in person, but I've seen videos where there's like a website where you can bet on games that not even like very big games, just like random sports games. Or like I saw one where you could bet on like a high school football game or something like that.
Thing is, it gets a bit sketchy because you get match fixing. You get fixed results because if people aren't getting, unless they're making NFL, NBA money, people are really susceptible. I think tennis True. Had a problem with this a while ago, where if you weren't in the top 20 in the world, you could really use an extra $100,000.
True.
And so it was open to a lot of dubious practices and game fixing. So that is something you'd want to be very wary of. It's a minefield. I can see why they legalize sports betting in the States, but it definitely feels like no one's quite sure. They've opened the gate and let the animals out and they don't quite know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I guess for sure there's a lot of comments anytime something crazy happens in a game that it's like fixed or that it's for the sports betting or it's scripted.
I bet they're not always wrong, people saying that.
Well, I mean, all publicity is good publicity.
To some extent, yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Although I feel like a comp fixing scandal would actually just not be good publicity, but you never know. Maybe we could spin it.
Yeah, it could be interesting. Makes things interesting. Okay, so I guess back to the topic. Financials. I think I covered everything in the financials then. What will success look like for you?
That's a really hard thing to define. I would say I expect the PCL to be a professional organization comparable to the best sports leagues in the world, maybe not in terms of revenue, but in terms of how well it's respected and how well it's run. I think these should be the best events in the history of climbing, both for the athletes and the fans. And I just hope that I know that the PCL will be kind of an industry defining organization. And I hope that, what would success look like?
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong, we have financial and sponsorship answers, but that's pretty dry. That's not really, I don't think, what you're getting at. I think.
I mean, if you want to talk about like success in terms of money, that works too.
Put it this way, if someone gives you $50,000, you've got to deliver $50,000's worth of value back to them. I mean, without wishing to state the obvious. So if you think about what the event costs, we've got to deliver that back in value to people. It's not always that easy to quantify. Henry Ford said the problem with marketing is that half the money you spend on it is wasted, but you don't know which half. And that's so true. So we've got to deliver that value, but more globally, I think success for me would be that more climbers watch comps, that everyone involved with climbing, everyone who goes to the gym is at least aware of PCL and hopefully watches it and is inspired by it, that the athletes love it, the athletes start making real money, and that this is a long-term, sustainable league that's here for the next decades.
I think it'd be so cool if the gyms could get involved in it. I think that would make a big difference.
Yeah, and I think slightly off away from what you talked about, what success, but one of the things we've talked about constantly is how do you link what people do in a gym to what happens in a comp? And that's something that's massively missing right now. You watch a comp, it's a comp, and you go to the gym, it's something completely different. And we have a lot of theories about how you might do this, and we have plans to make this a reality. But if we can link what goes on in a comp with what goes on in a gym, and you can create a synergy between those two, then I think we're really on to something. Because right now they feel so disconnected, they don't feel relevant to each other, and we need to do something about that.
Yeah, one of the gyms around me has like a, I guess like a World Cup wall, and they also play like comp climbing events on the TVs around. And I feel like that's a great way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's, we've got a lot of plans around this longer term for sure. Yeah. Stay
Nothing
tuned.
You can get into.
I probably shouldn't right now, but stay tuned on that one. Stay okay. tuned. We really want comps to be relevant to the gym experience, and we want to bring gyms along. I think the biggest expense for a climber right now is a gym membership. And so we really want gyms to be a big part of the PTL.
All right. So let's get into some of the other audience submitted questions. The first one, what will the schedule look like in the future? Will there be a regular circuit? And similarly, how will you select future locations and venues?
So there will be a regular circuit. We would like to get into bigger and bigger venues. So, we think we can get into big arenas. If you look at the IFSC selling out Bercy Arena in Paris, 2012, so what's that, 8 years before the first Olympics, 14 years ago, when the industry was less than half the size it is now, we think we can sell tickets in big arenas. Again, without wanting to state the obvious, if you pay to rent a 10,000-seat arena and sell 4,000 tickets, you've got a very big financial problem to solve. So we've got to be careful, you know, we've got to scale it. But yeah, there will be a regular circuit. We want to go to the biggest cities in the world and the best venues in the world. And one thing that's absolutely key about this is we're going to climbers. Climbers aren't coming to us. I think a lot of climbing comps are still held in climbing's traditional heartlands, which is the mountains. But climbing has changed beyond all recognition. Most climbers live in big cities. And don't climb outside. So we are going to them. They don't have to come to us. So we want to go to big cities, big arenas. I want to go to Madison Square Garden. I'll throw that out there right now. I think we should be, you know, we want to get in the Garden. We want to get in Wembley Arena. We want to be in Staples Center in LA. We want to go really big. So yeah, there'll be a regular circuit, but hopefully the venues get bigger every year.
Okay. Are there other locations already announced for this year?
No,
next year.
But there'll be a North American event next year, and there'll be another European event next year.
Like already confirmed or like hopeful?
Not confirmed. We know what the venues would be. We know where we'd be going, and we've found venues that we think work for us. But no, we haven't confirmed yet. They won't be confirmed before London, or very unlikely to be confirmed before London.
Just to clarify, next year is in like 2026, because yes. I guess this is coming out next year.
Yeah, 2026. Okay, there'll be multiple PCL events in 2026, beginning with London.
Okay, cool. Exciting. Next one, when you tested the PCL format, what aspect of it was the most engaging or exciting for the athletes?
The fact that there's someone standing right next to you, because it just fundamentally changes the way you behave. If I fall off a boulder and I've got 4 minutes, there's no one else on the stage, I can rest for exactly as long as I want to rest. If there's someone standing next to me who I've got to beat, that completely changes. So as simple as it sounds, it's the element of having to think about someone else's performance, because if I've got 4 minutes to myself and I know that I've got to top the boulder, I'm only focused on how to use that 4 minutes smartly for me to top the boulder. I don't have to worry what anyone else does. So just adding another person in there completely changes it. So I'd say that's the biggest thing. For the athletes, when you're watching, it's when people are really near the top of a boulder and they're head to head. And it's been remarkable a few times in the test how close people are. Like we had a move not long ago. You jumped out left and swung, and they were literally, it was like they were choreographed dancers, perfectly timed. And then there was a slower move and one of them did it a bit quicker than the other. And then the other one began to catch up. And when people are head to head, climbing at their limit near the top of a boulder, that's about as good as it gets.
Are there any like strategies you saw come up that were interesting?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I think we'll see lots more. I think that's one of the biggest unknown elements for us, is how will people actually interact with each other? So we did one test where there was a boulder that was kind of hard to read. And one of the people, so the pair run out, one of them just stepped back and watched the other person climb, which is so cool, because if the guy who's on the wall actually does it, you just look like an idiot because you just stood there. But you might glean this information that then enables you to do it. So we really want to see that interaction between the climbers, and we want to see tactics. You see it in every sport, that your opponent does one thing, so you react this way. And we want to see that. I think that's massive for us. And it's really, I can't even predict how people will interact with each other. I just know that they will. And I think I did the Red Bull dual ascent. There wasn't one this year. Anyway, the last 2 years, whatever. And looking across at your opponent is just this whole different world. And yeah, people do get tactical, and we encourage that. And I'm looking forward to seeing the world's best climbers under that kind of pressure.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see. Last one from Instagram. Will you use adjustable walls like last week in Grip Nijmegen? Sorry, is that terrible?
No, I had to ask a few times. Apparently it's pronounced Nijmegen.
Nijmegen.
Or
can I ask it again? You know what? Never mind. It's fine. I haven't heard of it before. It's fine.
Yeah, I've butchered me. You've had Matt Groom on here. Me and Matt between us have butchered enough names. So
I thought this was like, okay. For some reason I read this and I was like, that sounds like a Japanese thing.
No, it's in the Netherlands. Apparently it's a very nice city. We were there a week. I never went to the city once.
Mm-hmm.
I just drove back and forth to the hotels and the gym. But that's fine.
Yeah. So was that where you did the test event?
Yeah. So there's the biggest gym in the Benelux region is called Grip in Nijmegen. And it is a fantastic facility. And so we did the test there. On the adjustable walls, just have to watch.
Okay. Sad.
Let's just say there's probably a reason why we went and did the test at a place with adjustable walls.
I guess, like, what does adjustable walls look like? Like, just the, angle? Or?
Yeah. Yeah. You can change the angle.
Like a board?
Yeah. But then we're not using boards.
Okay.
I'm not sure what we can say about them. I don't know what what's out there and stuff. But put it this way, I wouldn't have flown to the Netherlands to test it on walls that can be adjusted for no reason.
Okay. Good to know.
I only got back not last night, the night before. So it's definitely feeling a bit second best, but it was worth it. That we'll be very creative with the route setting and the competition. Let's say that.
Well, I don't know how this person saw that, but is there like video online of this event, the test event?
Yeah, there's some. You have to check. If you have a look at Grip Nijmegen.
Yeah.
It's fine. I had no idea. I mean, where does the J come into it? Why is it?
Yeah. I have no idea.
The whole week I was trying to read Dutch. I speak a bit of German and a bit of Dutch as a mystery. Right. Anyway, if you go on the Grip Nijmegen Instagram socials and stuff, they've got some stuff. And over the next few weeks, you'll see a bit more from us and from Red Bull. So yeah, there'll be bits and pieces coming out from that.
Cool. Yeah, I'll have to take a look at that. Okay. Well, I think that covers all the questions then. Thanks for joining me again for the second time. Anything else that you want to let people know about, or thoughts on the whole 5 years of planning?
Hard to believe it's been 5 years. No, I would say to people, just be excited, help us out, support us, let us know what you think. We're not standing here saying we've got all the answers, but we're trying our very best to make this the best thing that's ever happened in climbing. So if you're in London, come along. Wherever you are, sign up for the socials at Pro Climbing League. Go to proclimbing.com, sign up for our email newsletter. Just support us, like our posts, tell us what you think, buy a ticket, get behind it. It's a huge moment for climbing to have a professional league starting like this. And it's happened. Every sport has in somewhere or other has a commercial league in it. And we're really excited that this is climbing is finally going to get one. I think it's going to be amazing for the athletes. I think it's going to be amazing for people watching. It's going to be amazing for gyms. I'm excited. So get excited. Help us out.
Awesome. Will be cool to see. I'll leave all of that in the description below as well. So yeah, thank you again. It was a good talk.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for making it to the end of the podcast. Don't forget to like and subscribe if you enjoyed. Otherwise, you are a super fake climber. If you're listening on a podcasting platform, I'd appreciate if you rate it 5 stars, and you can continue the discussion on the free competition climbing Discord linked in the description. Thanks again for listening.